Thank you, Judge Posner, and good morning. My name is Tom Quigley. I'm a deputy of the Indiana Attorney General. With me at council table is Eric Beaver, also a deputy attorney general. May it please the court, we're here this morning on an interlocutory appeal from a decision of the United States District Court in the Northern District of Indiana. The case presents three certified questions that arise from the Prison Litigation Reform Act of 1995. The case arose in the district court when the plaintiff, an Indiana state prisoner, filed a Section 1983 suit against several prison officials, claiming, among other things, that six of those officials had used excessive force during a cell extraction that occurred at the maximum control facility in Indiana in 2001. Four defendants appeared. They admitted the cell extraction, but they raised as an affirmative defense the defense of the plaintiff's failure to exhaust available administrative remedies. In due time, the case came on in a motion for summary judgment filed by the defendants raising only the exhaustion issue, and that motion for summary judgment, after being fully briefed, was granted by the district court. The case was appealed to this court, and in March 2006, this court reversed and sent the case back to the district court, finding that there were questions of fact that needed to be resolved. At that time, the plaintiff filed a jury demand, and in November of 2006, the district court entered an order that provided not only set a trial date, but provided that the question of exhaustion that the defendants would be allowed to prove their defense of exhaustion after the plaintiff had rested his case in chief. Thus, as the case now stands, exhaustion will not be determined in the district court until there has been a full airing of the merits of the defendant's prison conditions claim. The Prison Litigation Reform Act provides in its first subsection that no action shall be brought with respect to prison conditions until such administrative remedies as are available are exhausted. The statute does not say that no relief shall be granted until exhaustion has occurred. The statute doesn't say that no case shall be decided until exhaustion has occurred. The statute says no action shall be brought. It's impossible to give effect to that provision in the Prison Litigation Reform Act without deciding the question of exhaustion before even broaching the merits of the prison conditions claim. In 1999, this court gave full consideration to the exhaustion question in the PLRA to the provision of the statute requiring exhaustion in Perez versus Wisconsin Department of Corrections. That case is binding upon this court. It certainly is controlling authority. And in that decision, this court made several observations concerning the exhaustion requirement. One of those observations is that the requirement of exhaustion gives to defendants certain rights, and that when the defendants assert those rights, the judge must address the question of exhaustion immediately. This court also held in Perez that administrative and judicial claims may not go forward simultaneously. And this court determined in Perez that the statute, the PLRA's exhaustion requirement, can function properly only if exhaustion is decided before turning attention to the merits of the prison conditions claim.
Mr. Quigley, in this case, we have a rather unusual circumstance in that the controverted issues of fact with respect to the question of exhaustion are also issues of fact on the merits in the underlying litigation. If, as I understand your position, if the district court were to decide those controverted issues of fact from the bench in determining the exhaustion question, how could he then later comply with the Supreme Court's holding in the Beacon Theaters case that says you at all costs have to preserve the right of jury trial in a damages action such as this?
Your Honor, I think that there are two responses to that. The first is that the meaning of the Prison Litigation actually there are three answers. The meaning of the Prison Litigation Reform Act exists without regard to the particular facts of this case, and the statute has to be interpreted and applied as it stands on its own terms. I think the second point that needs to be made is I'm not sure, and I say this, Judge Ripple, with a great deal of respect, I'm not sure that the merits of the exhaustion question as it arises in this case are intertwined with the merits of the case. The exhaustion question, as the court has determined the question of fact to be, there's no question in this case that the plaintiff's arm was broken during the cell extraction. That's not seriously an issue. The defendants do not deny that the plaintiff was left-handed, and there's no way that the defendants can prove that he was able to write. That's not an issue either, or that he was unable to write. The plaintiff's exhaustion defense, or the plaintiff's response to exhaustion, was based on the concept that he was unable to get writing materials, and as I understand this court's ruling, that certain people, specifically a captain at that time, a major named George Payne, and a lieutenant, had told him that an investigation would be conducted. The defendants don't agree that that ever happened. And so but that has nothing to do with the merits of the excessive force claim.
Let's take those two situations. Let's take your view of the facts, and I'm concerned that there still might be an overlap when it comes down to quantum of damages. But let's leave that aside for a minute. Suppose there was no overlap on the controverted issues of fact, on the threshold issue of exhaustion, and on the merits. In your view, then, the district court is obligated by virtue of the statute to decide the exhaustion facts first. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he can do that without the help of a jury. Am I correct?
Absolutely. Can and should.
Okay. Why?
Why can? Because it's a threshold issue. It needs to be decided before the court even turns its attention to the matter of the merits, before the court turns its attention to the prison conditions claim. It should be done early. It should be done before discovery, before we even turn. And I think that that's the clear meaning of Perez.
Now, if you'll indulge me for a moment, let's take the facts as I first gave them to you. Suppose there is an overlap of facts, of controverted facts. In other words, the facts necessary to decide the exhaustion issue are also the facts that are necessary to decide the underlying merits of the case. Now what does the district court do?
The district court makes the determination of fact because that is the only, and it's done early on.
Well, would that bind the determination on the merits? Suppose the judge found that there was exhaustion, but the findings that he made were inconsistent with the merits claim of the petitioner. Would that bind the merits determination?
I don't know, Judge Posner. I would want to see particular facts
no.
and know that.
No.
I don't know.
You didn't want to see particular facts. That doesn't have anything to do with it. I'm giving you a hypothetical case in which the judge's finding on exhaustion is adverse to the merits claim of the petitioner. So he gets all over the exhaustion threshold. Judges found it's exhausted. But now the question is, what's the effect, if any, of the judge's findings in that exhaustion hearing on the merits?
I believe that the two issues would be separate, even if there were overlap, and that therefore...
So what you're saying, there would be no preclusive effect of the judge's finding.
That's where I'm going, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
I think that there would not be preclusive effect, because I don't think that the... Even if I think that there would be, the issues would overlap, but I think that they could be separated discreetly. And I think also.
That's not the good answer. No.
I'm sorry.
No. What you said before that is a better answer. That is, suppose the judge finds, in, somehow in the course of the exhaustion proceeding, he makes a finding that he didn't break his arm. Okay? Now the question is, if he gets over the threshold barrier, now there's a trial on the merits. Does he, does that finding then be admissible or preclusive or otherwise have an effect on the merits? Because if it does, you're infringing his jury right on the merits. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Of course, in Beacon Theaters, the court said you had to have the jury trial before, well, it was equitable in that case, but before the judge trial. That would be one way to do it. The other way would just say, no, that judicial finding, you know, it's like with a suppression hearing or something, doesn't bind the jury.
I think the answer to that would have to be that it doesn't bind the jury, Your Honor, that the jury would be free to make its own factual determination.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Krieger. We'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Freebus?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to pick up where Mr. Quigley left off. I do think that this Court ought to be concerned because the defendants are asking for a categorical rule that in every case would apply, even where, as Judge Ripple posed his hypothetical, or in this case, where the question of the facts of exhaustion would tie into the
But it's harmless if there's no preclusion, right? So.
Well, but it would be...
Why can't we look at the... why can't we look at the PLRA as simply a statutory abrogation of the usual rules of collateral estoppel?
Well, I think that there would be there's no basis to find that Congress intended to abrogate the regular rules of collateral estoppel.
How about the plain wording of the statute?
Well, I think the plain wording of the statute's problematic here. I think it's clear, and it's been well litigated, that the statute imposes a prerequisite on a plaintiff, a would-be plaintiff, that needs to exhaust his or her administrative remedies before going to court. But it doesn't prescribe a procedure for the district court to resolve the exhaustion question. The phrase brought in 1997 EA of the PLRA has been held by this court in Ford versus Johnson to literally mean when the complaint is tendered to the district court clerk for filing. But as the Supreme Court held in Jones versus Bach, and as this court has held for many years, exhaustion is an affirmative defense, so it needs to be...
But is it like other affirmative defenses? Because can't the judge raise the exhaustion issue sua sponte?
I don't believe that he can. I think that there's a difference between finding it on, say, a 1915A screening, if it's evident from the face of a complaint, but otherwise I think it's to be treated as an affirmative defense to be pleaded and proven by the defendants. So I think that there's a difference between, depends on what kind of, at what stage of the litigation the question arises. If it's not evident from the face of the complaint, then I think it needs to be pleaded and proven.
The judge can't and raise it on his own?
I don't believe they can. I think that it's
affirmative. What's your basis for that?
Well, this court in Perez noted, and I believe the Supreme Court in Jones versus Bach said it's an affirmative defense that can be waived by the defendants. So it's their burden to plead and prove it. And I don't see any basis in the statute other than Tolosi.
But even if you are correct on that, isn't my colleague's question still a very valid one? Isn't there still a question of whether this is like other affirmative defenses? I mean, a lot of things can be raised as affirmative defenses. Some are very much bound up with the cause of action, and some of them have nothing to do with the cause of action like this one. Why should we treat them all the same in this context?
Well, I don't see any basis with which to treat this as a different type of affirmative defense. I think that the court's decision in Jones versus Bach spoke. So if there's some reason to depart in the plain language of the statute, then perhaps there's a basis. Then that's when we treat this differently. But that if there's no basis, we shouldn't.
Well, Congress didn't make it clear that exhaustion is a threshold issue. It needs to be decided, right?
I respectfully disagree with that interpretation. I think that there's language in cases that call it a threshold issue, but I think that, for example, the way that it was used in Perez, I think that the court in Perez was merely trying to point out that at each stage of proof, the court needs to assure itself that the affirmative defense hasn't been met if it's been raised. So if at the pleadings or at summary judgment or at trial, the court needs to address the defense before reaching the merits, because only in that case will the defense be served.
But if we allow it to go to trial and to be treated simply as another affirmative defense for the jury to consider, aren't we frustrating the purposes of the PLRA? The government the prison authorities are, in fact, being put to the significant burden of having to litigate the case on the merits when maybe it shouldn't have even, the case shouldn't even be in court.
Well, I agree, and I think that's why the Davis versus Streakster case is so crucial to this, to the questions presented in this appeal. Because Davis considered the question, what kind of right or what kind of benefit are defendants entitled to by virtue of 1997 EA? The specific question brought was, is this the kind of right that supports an immediate appeal under the collateral order doctrine? And the collateral order doctrine requires a decision that resolves an important issue that's separate from the merits, but about the kind of right that would be lost if review wasn't permitted.
Is the jury trial on exhaustion then an interlocutory appeal? Is that what you're...
No, I guess what I'm saying is that I think Davis illustrates that...
Well, I don't understand. Where does the interlocutory appeal come in?
No, the question in Davis was...
Well, you mentioned the interlocutory appeal. I don't...
No, I said that...
It had something to do with something.
But the question in Davis was whether this
I'm
was...
I'm interested in Davis. What does interlocutory appealability have to do with this, with a question raised by Judge Ripple?
Well, under the collateral order doctrine, it says that if this is not the kind of right that supports an interlocutory or immediate appeal, then it's not the kind of right that's going to be lost if defendants are required to go through the burden of a trial. It's not a right not to be tried. It's not a right to be free from litigation. It's a right that can be vindicated at the end of trial.
No, but there's
or
a difference. Isn't there a difference between a right not to be tried, and this, all right, which we don't have here. The court's made that clear. And a situation where Congress has taken measures to simply make sure that a burden is not imposed on one of the plaintiffs unless an antecedent legal issue is resolved. It's entirely possible, is it not, for Congress to decide, yes, we're not, this isn't like qualified immunity, we're not allowing interlocutory appeals, etc., but we still want this threshold issue to be decided before the merits are reached.
And my response would be that there's no basis in the statute for that determination to say that that's what Congress's intent was. The statute says no action shall be brought.
So would your view be that if the defendant raises a factual issue about exhaustion, then you'd have the full trial where exhaustion, the merits, and so on would be all tried together?
Yes.
That's what you want.
Yes.
Yeah, that doesn't sound right. Also, what about if you have a situation where the judge or the defendant says, I think this is really a case for abstention. It really belongs in another court system. And there may be factual questions. How related is it, you know, and so forth. Would that also have to be tried by a jury?
Well, again, isn't that the Laurel Lyons case?
Answer my question. Would that have to be tried by a jury?
Absolutely.
Factual questions. You know, I sue for damages, a suit at law. And defendant says, you know, really, you've got a pending suit in another court. This court ought to abstain. He says, no, it's not really the same case. There are factual differences in this and that and that and the other. And these are factual issues. Now, is the plaintiff entitled to a trial on whether there should be abstention on the theory that abstention is an affirmative defense?
Well, abstention... I believe
well,
in the...
That's my question, yes or no?
No, because in that case it affects the power of the court to hear the case.
No, abstention is not jurisdictional. You don't have to abstain.
Well, but it's a discretionary power of the court. This is not a discretionary power of the court. It's whether the defendants can plead and prove the defense. So until they prove the defense, then all they're entitled to is dismissal of the suit.
It's a question of what... dispute resolution system you belong in. Do you belong in the court or do you belong in a prison grievance procedure or what? And those questions of, you know, allocation of initial authority to decide, we don't usually think of as issues that are put to a jury.
Sure, but there are judicial doctrines of abstention, and then there's the plain language of the PLRA.
There's no plain. I don't think there's any plain language here. This issue is not confronted in the statute. There isn't anything about jury trial. Also, are you making a constitutional argument or a statutory argument or both arguments?
Well, I think that there are constitutional problems to the defendant's position.
Sir, I mean, you think it's unconstitutional? for a court to resolve the exhaustion issue without a jury trial?
Yeah, I think it implicates the rules in Beacon Theater and Dairy Queen.
You mean it would violate the Seventh Amendment. Is that what you're saying?
Violates the Seventh Amendment. Yes. So I think that there are... I don't think that the Congress spoke to this issue in the statute, and I think that in the absence of a clear congressional...
Now, wait a second. First you said it was plain. Now you say that Congress didn't speak to it. Now you say because it didn't speak to it, we have to have some presumption, interpretive presumption. I don't know where you're getting all this stuff.
Let me clarify, Judge Posner. The plain language of the statute does not impose a procedure on the district courts for resolving the defense. In the absence of any language indicating a procedure for the district courts, I think that this court ought to treat it like any other affirmative defense and allow it to go to the jury. See, my time is up.
So, Mr. Quigley, your time had expired, but we'll give you...
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I don't think there's anything I can add to the discourse that's already occurred. The Seventh Amendment, I think, doesn't apply here. The Seventh Amendment applies to suits at common law where the value in controversy exceeds $20, and this is not a suit at common law. This is a statutory Section 1983 suit under constitutional law. Other than that, I think the only question here is whether the court's reasoning in Perez was correct, and if it was correct, if the court meant what it said in Perez, and if it was correct and the court did mean what it said in Perez, then I think the result in the case, that this case is foreordained, and the court must reverse the decision and the orders of the lower court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you to both counsel. Mr. Freebus, you were asked to represent your client, and we thank you for your excellent efforts on his behalf.